Okay, well, thank you all for coming, and thanks especially to David for having invited me for the 2 weeks back at the ITP, and it's been very fun. And I thought just to begin, I want to show you a little bit of what I've been doing here. It's not actually on the topic at all, but is related to what I mentioned in the colloquium. You remember I told you cold dark matter was having problems on small scales. And these are shown, this is work done with Paul Bode and Jerry Ostreicher at Princeton. This is standard cold dark matter, and you see the galaxies here. So 20 megaparsec box. Galaxies here are these objects, and then there are lots of little sort of freckles, which are the micro halos. And there are way too many of them. You ask how many there are predicted to be in the Milky Way halo, it's about 1,000, okay, in this thing. 1,000 objects bigger than 10 to the 7 solar masses should be observable, and they're not there.
Would they be globular clusters or something today? Or?
No, they're bigger than that. They'd be dwarf galaxies.
There are only
7 satellite dwarf galaxies of our halo. So we've done some simulations of warm dark matter, and they are dramatically different. You notice the voids here are basically empty in this warm case. And also, if you do a high resolution zoom in.
The difference is that the warm stuff finds it harder to.
It's partly that, and partly that it's wiped out the small scale structure at early times. So the stuff warm is initially relativistic. And before matter radiation equality, it basically moves. When it comes across the horizon, the particles just move, and that smears out the small structure. So it's partly the phase-based density of these particles that can't increase, but it's actually mainly just the smearing of the fluctuations on small scales. So now if you look at a high-resolution picture of these two halos, this is the cold. And sorry for the quality, I just did this with XV and grabbed it, so you see the pixels, but never mind. You can see lots of the little dimples here, okay, and inside this galaxy you see lots of red splotches. But if you look at the warm one, these things are gone. They're actually much clearer on the screen, you can't see it very well here. But the interesting thing is that the clustering pattern of small galaxies is totally different in these two scenarios. In the one scenario, you have loads of them everywhere. In fact, if you plot the small objects, that's where they are. This is their mass. That's where they are in lambda CDM. And if you plot them in this warm thing, they are actually the little objects actually tracing out the same sheets that the large objects are in. So this is sort of one of the key observational discriminants. What one has to do to check it is to compute the correlations between big galaxies and little galaxies. And that's actually something nobody has done for some reason, but which can be done.
Little galaxies are how big?
The simulation only goes down to a resolution of a few times 10 to the 8.
Warm means that all the dark matter is warm already has
an extra. No, all warm.
But what was warmer?
What?
You had
warmer. Well, yeah, there's a free parameter to adjust, which is the warmth. Okay. It's basically the mass, yeah. If you assume it decouples
isn't
thermally.
Primack has been
saying. No, he's been talking about mixed.
He wants
mixed.
Want
yeah, there's not. There's hardly
warm compared. Some warm is compared to everybody.
Yeah, he has mixed. He has mixed. Yeah, this is. I mean, it's not a profound idea, but I think what is profound is that by studying observational signatures like this, high-resolution observational signatures, we may even be able to distinguish these things. And by the way, it's not clear it works, because if you look at high redshift, this is redshift 1, 2, and 3, actually. If you look at high redshift, you see if you make it too warm, there's nothing there. And so you see there are no galaxies at all at redshift 3. So this is certainly ruled out. And this one may work. Okay, so there's a delicate balance between wiping out something and destroying a high redshift.
What mass
does one correspond to?
Oh, this one corresponds to a 400 electron volt particle. And I think really to make this work, it's going to have to be about 1 keV.
Okay.
because this is already, this is overdoing it, actually. This is wiping out too much of the little guys.
What are the dark blue regions in that?
It's just the code. Here.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, dark blue.
Yeah.
It's just density is plotted. So those are, you know, slight underdense regions. Slightly underdense regions.
What is the spectrum that you're actually talking?
Nothing. Okay. Right, so I'm going to talk about cosmological instantons. And again, thanks for the opportunity to give a few more details. There are a number of references on this subject. And I guess the notes go out on the web, so they will be in the notes. First of all, I wanted to just make a general comment, which is, you know, I was talking to David. David kindly took me to dinner on Saturday, and in his usual aggressive manner was basically saying, why are you working on this stuff? This is ancient history, and...
We don't know.
What? No, glad to see he hasn't. So I sort of spent a while thinking of, you know, some apologia for working on this. But the more I thought about it, the less I thought I needed an apologia, because this is work related to a realistic theory, okay, inflation, quantum fluctuations, which the observations seem to be pointing towards. It has problems, profound theoretical problems, right? Non-renormalizability of gravity, the Euclidean action isn't positive, the sum over topologies doesn't converge, and we don't understand the cosmological constant. But we have to tune that by hand, so we have problems. But the way I see it, at the moment, if you want to do theoretical cosmology, you have a choice. Basically, you work on a realistic theory, which has problems, or you work on an unrealistic theory, which has even more problems. Okay? Now, let's consider M-theory. Okay? So, does M-theory, is it really renormalizable? Probably not. Probably not finite.
Sorry,
I mean, we don't know, but it is no...
I
agree with that. Okay, fine. Well, nobody knows. All right? And it has not been proved to be finite. What?
What
are you going to? Oh, you're the one who define it. So.
No, but it is.
Okay. Different people mean different things by M theory. Maybe that's another problem, which I would add to the list.
Well, it's just called string theory.
Okay. String theory, fine. Maybe that's finite. But then I would say there are many problems, supersymmetry breaking. There are many practical problems, okay, which you have to face. Supersymmetry breaking, you've got to stabilize all these extra dimensions you introduce. A very profound problem is there are no known cosmological solutions to superstring theory. None. That if we write, you know, really ask for the beta function to be zero, there just aren't any cosmological solutions.
Exactly.
No. Right. Exact solutions.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know where to begin. So you know, that's by way of an excuse for working on a theory which has problems that I don't see string theory or M theory addressing those problems. It might, which will be wonderful when it does. But so far it doesn't address those problems. And one of them, you could say, this Euclidean action not being positive, one way to get out of that is just to say, well, let's not have a Euclidean theory, let's just have a Lorentzian theory. But I think by that problem, what I mean is the initial conditions problem. See, because the way that really hits you in this work is that you have to understand, you need a positive Euclidean action. Why? Because you want to understand initial conditions. And M-theory or string theory so far hasn't really shed any light on the initial conditions problem. And so if it does so without needing any Euclidean techniques, then fine. But so far that hasn't happened.
So now your question. You said there's no cosmological solution of string theory.
Yeah.
Would you say the same about supergravity? You said there's no cosmological solution of supergravity?
No, there are. There definitely are. I mean, you define supergravity from its classical Lagrangian. There are lots of cosmological solutions. They're not realistic, but there are solutions. They have extra dimensions collapsing and all sorts of things going haywire, but there certainly are solutions.
And Neil just means that when the curvature gets to be more of the string scale, there'll be alpha prime corrections.
So nobody knows what happens to that.
What Neil means is string theory is a theory that is complete and smart enough to tell you what exactly the limitations and
that's
even enable you to calculate the corrections to the order, which of course is useless, but at least it tells you what to do when you get to singularity, where the framework you're working in doesn't have any idea what to do.
Oh, no, it knows exactly what to do. I mean, you'll see the problems. Oh, yeah, you'll see the problems.
Oh, you'll see the problems.
Right? Yeah.
I'm sort of surprised that David would, I mean, he gave this list of fundamental problems in physics.
Yeah.
And numbers one and two, as I remember, were basically quantum cosmological
problems.
What's environmental, what's non-environmental?
Yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't objecting to the question.
What's the origin of the universe?
The approach. Okay, well, as I said, this approach has some virtues. I don't think one has to be too apologetic about it. And if, you know, through these sort of primitive explorations, we actually shed some light on these questions, then of course we'll be very gratified. Okay, so let me now talk about the no boundary proposal, Hartle and Hawking. And at least the way I'm going to talk about it, it's really a philosophy more than a definite scheme. What? So maybe Jim will disagree with my interpretation of it. You know, a lot of Stephen and Jim's paper is about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and mini superspace, but I'm not going to talk about that at all. Okay. The spin that I'm going to put on it is that the sort of profound idea there is that by continuing a Lorentzian space-time to Euclidean, by making time go imaginary, you can round off the universe, and so that there is no boundary. And that's the part that, you know, I find most appealing and most profound. And as I said during the colloquium, this is certainly the most conservative thing you could do. It doesn't mean it's right. In fact, people say that's why it's wrong, because it's too conservative. Okay. It's not radical enough, but it's definitely the most conservative thing you can do. Now, let's talk about implementing the no boundary proposal in an inflationary model. And nothing I say will depend very strongly on the details of the scalar field potential.
Sorry, Nick, just a general question.
Yeah.
Does the no boundary proposal necessarily mean that space is compact? I mean, can it be implemented in a case like ADS where space is not compact?
I think not. I think it can only be implemented in ADS if you put a brain that basically cuts off the boundary.
You have this instanton which slices and opens up to an open cosmology.
That's right. But if you slice, there is a slicing which is compact. It's just not the slicing that is constant density.
So when you look at the map onto a universe which is open, doesn't mean there isn't some other.
There may be other spatial slicing which are non-compact. That's right. But there has to be a spatial slicing which is compact. That's right. Okay. So what we're going to do to implement Hartle and Hawking's proposal is rather definite. Okay, which is to say, let's find a classical solution of this form. And then we will quantize the small fluctuations in that background and do perturbation theory around that background. So that's rather a definite way of doing this, okay? And the problems will reveal themselves in that perturbation theory about the classical background. So now we are going to look for solutions. And for a generic inflationary theory, as I explained in the colloquium, there is a one-parameter family of solutions. In fact, there are two one-parameter families, but let's focus on one of them. One set is where the scalar field starts at some value, phi naught, on the potential, and in the Euclidean region rolls uphill, and then the Einstein equation in the Euclidean region is roughly b double prime is minus b times the potential, and so whereas it's plus b times the potential in the Lorentzian region. So here you get a sinusoidal behavior of the scale factor, which means it closes, and as I said, the scalar field zooms off to infinity. And then the surprising thing we noticed is that such configurations have finite Euclidean action. Now, before David, I think, in the colloquium said, well, why 04? Why should you focus on solutions which are 04? Especially if you're going to allow singularities, maybe there are all kinds of solutions. And one answer is that the solutions are lowest Euclidean action, and there's some evidence. For example, people have investigated Bianchi 9 solutions like this, and they do find that the 04 solution is the lowest action. But I think there's actually more profound answer, which is that, in fact, what I'll show you later, that we've shown the fluctuation action is positive for non-04 invariant perturbations. But I think there's a more profound answer, which is if you think in usual flat space time tunneling, there's an instanton, okay? So forget about gravity, just have tunneling out of a false vacuum. There is an instanton, and it's 04 invariant. And Coleman et al. Showed that this was the lowest action point on trajectories joining the false vacuum to the true vacuum. But in fact, that instanton is the only solution of the classical field equations with that property. It's the only one. It's not just the lowest action one. It is the only solution of the field equations. If you take something non-04 invariant and evolve it outwards in radius, it blows up at some point, you get infinite action, you get singularities. So this was proven by Guidas et al. In 1979, is that the 04 invariant tunneling instanton in flat space is the only solution of the field equations which crosses the barrier. And so what I think is natural to conjecture in these instantons, you see, they are singular, so we're going to have to resolve that singularity and understand it. But what I will conjecture is that when you do that, and I'll show you how to do that, these are in fact the only solutions of the classical field equations. Okay, that if you perturb this in some way, as you run to the singularity, basically it will have all the wrong properties to match to do the antipodal identifications I'm going to do. So I'm going to conjecture that these are actually the only classical solutions of the field equations.
Yeah. Including solutions of different topology or excluding those as well?
No, of fixed topology, absolutely. Okay, so now I just want to discuss in a little more detail how these solutions work. So we have this object. And the metric is d sigma squared plus b squared of sigma m 3 squared. Oh, thanks. And if we compute the Euclidean action, it's integral root g minus 1 over 2 kappa r plus 1 half grad phi squared plus v of phi. And if you have a space with a boundary, then there's a boundary term. And that boundary term is there to basically cancel second derivatives in the action, so that if you consider the variational problem with the three metric fixed on the boundary, then you get the classical solutions. And that was, as far as I know, first found by Dirac, this term. Now, if we look at this, when you solve the field equations, the scalar field equation looks like this. And as a thing goes zooming off up the hill and B turns around, this becomes anti-damping. And so that as you approach the singularity, phi dot goes like 1 over B cubed. Okay, now if you look at the Einstein equation, B dot over B squared is proportional to phi dot squared. And this tells you that B goes like sigma to the 1/3. Okay, and as I mentioned, that's completely generic behavior. It doesn't matter Kähler potential or non-minimal coupling. You get the same result there. So when you go and evaluate the Ricci scalar, this goes like 1 over sigma squared. This goes like 1 over sigma squared. It's the derivative of phi. And this metric is b cubed, so that goes like sigma. And you see that these two terms are each logarithmically divergent, but they cancel. And the fact they cancel, you can see just by taking the trace of the Einstein equations. G mu nu equals T mu nu. If you take the trace, then R is grad phi squared. So that's independent of dimension, actually. For any dimension, these two terms cancel. This potential term, of course, V is going to infinity, but only logarithmically in sigma, because you see the scalar field is going like 1 over sigma, so phi diverges logarithmically. And so that's perfectly integrable. And when you work out the boundary term, this boundary term is something like B cubed dot. It's the rate of change of the volume of the spatial slices here, if you think of sigma as a time. And that's a constant. Okay, so this turns out to be finite, but there are some worrying things about it. One of which is that individually these terms, certainly the density is going to infinity, and individually these terms are infinite. And secondly, the fact that there's this boundary term makes you worry that the whole thing's ill-defined, because you can always add an arbitrary function of the three metric on the boundary, okay, and get a perfectly good classical action. So we need to understand that boundary if we're going to understand anything. Now, having got these solutions, though, I'm going to come to that in a minute. Having got these solutions, let me explain what you can do with them. So we've got the solution. It has a surface, a three surface, on which the normal derivatives of the metric and the scalar field are zero. And what that means is that you can now analytically continue this. Okay, so basically, if you think about the scalar field, if phi dot is zero, that means that phi will have a power series expansion only in even powers of this normal coordinate. And because it's even powers of tau, let's say, call that tau, if I say tau is it, then phi will still stay real in the Lorentzian region. So you need these normal derivatives to be zero so that you'll get a real classical background solution in the Lorentzian region. And by the way, I'm going to insist this be real in both the Euclidean and the Lorentzian regions. The reason for insisting it be real here is that if you did think about quantizing the small fluctuations around a complex classical solution, you would not have a Hermitian Hamiltonian. Okay, so you would not get unitary behavior for the fluctuations. So the reality is important here so that you have Hermitian Hamiltonian for the fluctuations. Now, this analytic continuation, I think the best way to think about it is completely locally. Just cut out a little piece of the space and think of that's flat, and now you do the standard continuation in flat space. Okay? It's completely unique because if you consider a field which does not couple to gravity, for example, electroweak gauge fields or QCD, you want the analytic continuation to give them a positive Euclidean action in this region. Okay? And demanding that the Euclidean action for all the other fields in the standard model be positive is enough to fix the sign of the continuation. So some people, for example, Linde, have argued that the sign is ambiguous. You could have e to the plus s or e to the minus s. It doesn't make any sense to me, because if you consider a field coupling weakly to gravity, in other words, playing no role in this object, those fields, if you want them to have a sensible Euclidean action, that fixes the sign. Okay, so I don't think there is any ambiguity in the sign of the Euclidean action. The analytic continuation is completely fixed by taking a local point of view and saying the space is locally flat. And then you have to do the Wick rotation of ordinary flat space field theory. Okay, so now you look at these solutions, I'll show you what you can do with them. First of all, you can just do the obvious thing and calculate the action.
There's no problem there with the sigma equals zero.
no problem with analytic continuation. When you blow this thing up, okay, so that's how we'll resolve a singularity. We blow it up, okay, and then it will be a boundary. I mean, it's you blow it up with a conformal transformation, then there will be this boundary, but this surface is symmetric. And in fact, I'm going to identify antipodal points on this surface. And I don't think...
That depends on a particular
law. Yeah. Can only resolve it with a particular blow-up. Actually, it will turn out from the analysis of the fluctuations that they all have to vanish at this boundary. Any fields which are not conformally coupled are forced to vanish at this boundary. Conformally coupled fields, like photons, don't have to vanish here, and then you can only decide what they do by adopting some particular regularization scheme.
The scheme that you have there, if you didn't have it, your singularity would blow up into a bubble, basically, that's growing in the Lorentzian.
No, it's always of zero size. The bubble has zero size. The area of the bubble surface is zero.
In the Lorentzian?
In the Lorentzian.
Wow.
Well, it's zero here. Zero here.
Sometimes
the Lorentzian.
It looks like it's expanding.
It can look like it's expanding, but if you actually measure the area.
No, I mean, if you're at a. Didn't someone show that if you're at some proper distance from this thing at the nucleation point, then
it hits you.
It takes as much time as the light ray until it hits. I mean, it hits you.
It does hit. Yes. If you follow co-moving observers here, they move and they hit this trajectory.
Right.
That's
so,
right.
So in that sense, it's moving up because I think it's reaching more and more of these co-moving observers as you move up. So I'm just wondering.
Well,
your identification scheme basically means that you're suing across this Lorentzian geometry as well, right? So you're basically just
saying that.
In some sense.
And what does the picture look like once you blow it up?
Yeah.
This is the Lorentzian section, so far.
What do they look like?
Just,
yeah. So we cut it here, and then what does it look like? It's hard to draw. I think the easiest. Yes, I'll show you what it looks like. The easiest way to do it is that in this frame. This is, you can take the double cover of the space-time, okay? So I'm going to identify these antipodal points, but you can always take the covering space, okay? And then what it looks like when you continue is de Sitter space, okay, with two copies, okay? So basically, the conformally blown-up metric looks like this, but now, in this de Sitter space, you can think of this as basically a domain wall running down the middle of it, of the de Sitter space. And I'm going to adopt a particular prescription for even fields being even and odd with respect to that domain wall. Okay, that's what this identification amounts to.
I have a hard time picturing what the equivalent is to the nothing bubble hitting co-moving observers, more and more of them. I mean, here it seems like there are more and more points that are sort of running into each other. Do you not get any problems from that?
I haven't thought about particle geodesics very much, I must admit. What I've thought about is the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And these scalar fields, when you quantize them, they're forced to be zero on this point. So basically, you can think of them as being odd functions under this identification, and they're forced to be zero here. So,
basically, what I'm wondering is, if I'm one of these observers that, without your identification, would have been hit by the bubble, am I going to be hit by my mirror image, or what's?
Presumably, you're hit by your opposite mirror image, which cancels you out and stops you going there. I presume that's what happens, but I haven't. Study that in detail. I'll show, it's easy to see why they're forced to be zero at that point.
And if it's a non-singular identification, you just go around and come on the other side.
Why is it? This is in the conformally blown up frame.
Right.
Okay. The conformal factor is going to zero at this point. the metric is vanishing at this
point. Still the singular.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I guess that also answers my next question, because I was going to ask, I mean, you said the boundary term produces a finite contribution.
Right.
If you just cut it off and take the limit.
That's right.
So when you do this identification, and it says get rid of the boundary.
That's right.
You get rid of that term? Or you
yes, you do. Okay, that's what I'm going to show you. Okay, so let me jump to this section.
That term was small compared to the
well, it's finite. Actually, it had an important effect. Let me just jump to this regularizer.
I can wait if you want to go through it.
Okay, all right. Let me go through this then a little more. So let me, rather than flip the thing up and down, let me just show this briefly, because I just want to make a simple point. But if you calculate this action, I don't know if you can read that. What? Can you read that? I think you can read that. You can show that if you compute the Euclidean action, it's 1 over V for this potential, where you start. In other words, it's this massively favors you starting near the bottom, okay, this term. But there's actually a finite contribution from the boundary term, which takes this form. You can compute it approximately. It depends on the slope of the potential. And you see this boundary contribution actually disfavors you being right at the bottom. Okay, so if V is sort of phi squared, for example, this would be a 1 over phi cubed, and that would be a phi. So this goes like minus 1 over phi squared, so, and it has the opposite sign. So actually that term disfavors you being at the bottom. Sorry, it's 1 over phi cubed, so it actually beats this term. So when you compute the most probable instanton, just using e to the minus se, then it actually gives you a picture like this, where the most probable one has the scalar field starting at 2.5 Planck masses, and then anything higher is sort of exponentially suppressed. And if you translate it into the number of e-foldings, then the probability of getting n e-foldings in inflation is e to the minus 10 to the 13 over ne. So it's massively disfavors a large number of e-foldings. So that was the sort of bad news for inflation or quantum cosmology from these instantons. And if I have time, I will tell you how that may be fixed by computing the appropriate operators. Okay, so let me now switch to this. So just to, because time is limited, I'm not going to show you the detailed calculation of the fluctuations. Okay.
Well, you don't even have the luxury of adjusting the potential to be some weird thing. It's just not working.
No. Actually, that's not quite true. You can pick potentials which, a potential which is very, very flat at large phi basically does work. Will give the right number of e-foldings.
Why is that any worse than...
Well, I always felt nervous about it, okay? It did work. We contemplated writing a paper about it. But the reason I felt nervous about it is that if you have such a flat potential, then the scalar field fluctuations can be very large, and it seems they might drift off to infinity. And so I did feel very nervous about it, and turns out, rightly now, I believe, because when we computed the homogeneous mode perturbations of the instanton, in that situation you find they're enormous, and the instanton doesn't actually make any sense. It's not a the fluctuations are big around that instanton. So yeah, that's not really an option. Okay, so to do the cosmological perturbations, let me just say in principle what one does, and to say that we've done it. So the principle of it is, which I've now lost, what I call the backwards and forwards method. Okay, and so it's backwards and forwards because, first of all, we consider this theory in the Lorentzian region. Okay, we consider small fluctuations around this classical solution in the Lorentzian region. We perform a Hamiltonian reduction in that region. Take the path integral, integrate out the constraints, that forces you to only physical degrees of freedom. Do that in the Lorentzian region. You now get a first order action for momentum and coordinate in the Lorentzian region. You eliminate the momentum by integrating it out, and now you have a coordinate space action which you continue to the Euclidean region. You compute the Euclidean correlator in the Euclidean region. It's unique. The beautiful thing about this Euclidean idea is that the Green's function, the solution to operator G equals delta function, is unique in the Euclidean region. Okay, and that Green's function analytically continues to the Feynman correlator in the Lorentzian region. So we do that and compute this Euclidean Green's function and then analytically continue back to the future. Okay, back to the Lorentzian region. And so let me just briefly show you what the answer is. And by the way, in this calculation, because the space-time is... Okay, all right. Because the space-time is not time translation invariant, it's quite complicated. So you take this instanton, you compute the correlator between two points on the instanton. This is done for the gauge invariant Newtonian potential. It's the variable that we're considering. And what you find is a sort of Schrodinger equation in Euclidean space that you have to solve. You can write down the formal solution in terms of scattering amplitudes. Turns out there is a bound state as well. And that gives a separate contribution. So there's a continuum and a bound state. You compute the Green's function. You then use the analytic properties of these Yost functions, right, in a very important way, in a crucial way, to analytically continue into Lorentzian space. And when you've done all that, then you get this Lorentzian correlator. This is the symmetrized correlator. And it includes all sorts of nasty factors, including reflection amplitudes you have to calculate by solving this Euclidean scattering problem. And there's also this bound state continues to something called a supercurvature mode, which is that in the open universe, as well as the ordinary continuum of modes, fluctuation modes, there can be modes that, so normally the normal modes satisfy minus Laplacian is greater than 1 in curvature units. But there are there are modes whose wavelength is longer than the curvature scale. These are called supercurvature modes. For a long time, there was a great deal of ambiguity how to treat these modes. And this was not really resolved until we did these calculations. And the way it's resolved is you simply work in real space. Okay, so the mode expansion is just a tool. The principle is you compute the correlator in real space and time, Euclidean, I should say, continue into in real space and time, and that gives you a unique answer. And that shows there is a supercurvature contribution, which comes from this bound state.
In what sense is the answer unique?
It's unique because in the Euclidean, the problem you end up solving in the to get the correlator is just that box G, or operator. You've got some quadratic operator for the fluctuations. So you have to solve that equation. And in Euclidean space, that the solution is unique. There is no solution to this equation in Euclidean space. Whereas in Lorentzian space, there are infinite number of solutions.
So, in the space you're talking about, it's the conformally resolved singularity.
No, I'm actually talking about it in these original variables.
Some boundary condition with the singularity.
Okay, so there are several ways of seeing how the boundary condition emerges at the singularity. Let me see if I can get this right. So basically, you have an action. And it's most convenient if you go to a coordinate x, where x is integral d sigma over b. It's like a co-moving or conformal coordinate. And then when you do that, the action looks like this, where phi is the fluctuating field. Okay, that's the kinetic term of the action. As I mentioned in the colloquium, this behaves like X near the singularity. And if you now solve the field, when you work out the eigenvalue problem, it basically looks like this, okay? And there are two solutions to this equation, which I may or may not get right. One is that phi goes like log X, and the other one is that phi goes like X to the 1/2 log X. And if you now go and compute the action, so there are two sets of modes, fluctuation modes. And if you compute the Euclidean action for these fluctuation modes, it turns out that for one of them, the one that diverges at the singularity, you get infinity. And the other one, you get a finite number. So the Euclidean action itself tells you to ignore this set of modes. Okay, so you can do this without blowing up the singularity. But as I emphasized, this is only true for the modes which depend on this coordinate, okay, non-trivial harmonics. The trivial harmonics on this coordinate do not have this property, that the action does not actually uniquely select one. So those are the real problem, is that the modes that are constant on these three spheres do not have a unique boundary condition. The only way to determine the boundary condition is by imposing some regularization here. And to translate that into what it means is the cosmological perturbations, delta T over T, they only depend on the the inhomogeneous modes here. And so those ones have unique boundary conditions. But if you want to ask what's the probability for the Hubble constant, or the mean density of the universe, that's a fluctuating thing, and that does depend on the boundary conditions there. Okay. So, I showed you some pictures of predictions. You can translate those correlators into microwave anisotropies. And basically the point is, because we've got this one parameter family of solutions here, you can think about these as having a constraint defined at the singularity, and that constraint directly determines the value of the density parameter. It's just like a little dial that you can turn to adjust omega. And then you get unique, for each omega, you get a unique prediction for the pattern of density perturbations. Okay, so...
Don't you say that the most likely value of omega is
very small? Very small. Okay, so... Yeah, it's minuscule. So what you can do in this framework is just by hand select a classical solution with a high value of omega. The calculation is still consistent of the fluctuations, but, you know, there's no doubt you've just held it by hand. You fixed omega to be something. And what I talked about in the colloquium, and I think I probably won't have time to go into detail, is that if one says you shouldn't just compute the correlators of omega, you should compute the correlators of rare events with omega, okay, then you introduce a weighting factor, which is basically the volume change during inflation, and that actually pushes you up towards omega of 1. This is the mathematical anthropic principle, okay, in another guise. Okay, so I want to talk about this regularization, though. So as I mentioned, the basic idea is very simple.
You use more of a blackboard.
Oh, yeah. I think in... fine. So the basic idea is very simple, that if we start with this, the Einstein frame metric, okay, and if we change to that coordinate x, then this becomes b squared of x dx squared plus d omega 3 squared. Okay, so now you've made the space conformal to a cylinder, and x converges to a finite value at the singularity, so which you can define to be 0. So you have this conformal boundary. And furthermore, in these solutions, this function has special behavior. It actually vanishes linearly with x. Okay, so you have a linear conformal zero. And, you know, that suggests something simple is going on, that by doing an appropriate conformal transformation, you could make this perfectly regular. So now let's do a conformal transformation. We say that our Einstein frame metric is omega squared times a Riemannian metric. Okay, by Riemannian I mean positive definite. So, but I'm going to allow the conformal factor to vanish. So if we do that and write down the action for the Riemannian, so all our differential geometry is going to be in terms of this Riemannian frame metric. And when we write that down, we get integral square root of g Riemannian minus 1 over 2k omega squared Ricci scalar, the Riemannian metric, minus 3 over k grad omega squared plus 1 half omega squared grad phi squared plus omega to the fourth phi of phi minus, and I'm going to write out the boundary term explicitly, root hr omega squared k of hr, where, so that's the trace of the second fundamental form on this boundary. Now, when you write it in this form, you realize that omega equals zero is a coordinate singularity on the space of fields. Okay, because this is like dr squared plus r squared d theta squared. You say r equals zero is a polar coordinate singularity. And so what we do here is change to Cartesian coordinates on the space of fields. And so we'll make this to 3 over k grad omega plus grad omega minus, where these are, see, it's a Lorentzian signature space. You always get the wrong sign term from gravity. So you get this where these light cone coordinates, omega plus or minus, are equal to omega e to the plus or minus phi root kappa over 6 times phi. Okay, so we're going to say that the theory is really defined in terms of these coordinates. Now, when you do this, it's nice because now the action is finite term by term. Okay, there's nothing that's infinite. You've built in the cancellation of between these two terms. You can, and furthermore, the if the boundary is defined to be the place where omega squared is zero, then this term disappears. So in these variables, there is no boundary contribution. Okay. And each term in the action is finite, term by term. Yeah.
So, I mean, the boundary term is a geometric quantity, trace, extrinsic curvature, etc.
Right.
But how can you get rid of it by changing variables?
Yes. Let me think. It is zero because
could it have been moved to the volume term?
It's moved to the volume term, yeah. I mean, the way in which it happens, I tell you in more detail, is that when you do this conformal transformation, this isn't the only piece you get.
And there's a surface term.
There's another surface term. And that surface term exactly cancels the term you get from the conformal transformation of this k. When you do a conformal transformation of k, it doesn't just go like omega squared. There's another bit. And those two cancel. Yeah. Okay. So, all right, so it's clearly a much nicer action. It has lots of symmetries. Of course, because when I wrote this down, this split between Riemannian and omega was arbitrary. Okay, so there's a conformal symmetry where omega goes, a local conformal symmetry, omega goes to 1 over omega, and in fact that's true of omega plus and minus, and g goes to omega squared times g. So this Lagrangian's got local conformal symmetry. A second symmetry he's got is a symmetry on this superspace, which is hyperbolic. So there's an 011, so this is the first symmetry. There's an 011 symmetry, which is only asymptotic as you approach the singularity, because basically this term breaks it. You see, everything else in the action involves omega plus, omega minus, and so, which is invariant under 011, but this potential term breaks it. So you basically have a soft breaking of this 011. And the third symmetry you have is a Z2 symmetry, which is reversal of orientation. D4x goes to minus D4x, and omega plus minus goes to minus, plus minus omega plus minus. Okay, so I can rewrite this as omega plus omega minus, and now the action is invariant under the Z2, and that Z2 I'm going to use to perform the identification of the on this conformal boundary. So I blow up the boundary and then identify antipodal points here, and then the claim is that within this framework these solutions solve the classical field equations on RP4. Now, I mentioned before that when you introduce a boundary, you worry that there's an arbitrary function of the boundary metric allowed. Okay, and that obviously that's incompatible with the snow boundary proposal. But when we go to these regular coordinates, you see that actually you can't do that if you insist on certain symmetries. Okay, so if we insist on this conformal symmetry and on this symmetry being exact near the singularity, then it turns out that there is no term which is allowed as a function of the boundary metric. The reason is that, so you might think of writing something down like root HR times the Ricci scalar of H, okay, some local function of the metric on the boundary. That would be a coordinate invariant term. But the trouble is that this is a three-dimensional boundary. This would, to make this conformally invariant, you would have to have an omega cubed in there to make this conformally invariant. But this is an even power of h, and so you'd need an even power of omega. And so basically any local functional of the three metric requires odd powers of omega, but the 011 requires only even powers. You can't make an invariant of 011 with odd powers. So we argue that any such term is excluded by this symmetry.
This would break the symmetry in the action.
That's right.
It wouldn't break the symmetry in the equations of motion.
I think it would break the symmetry in the equation of motion too. It would.
I mean, you're not varying this term.
It would give you a delta function contribution, I guess.
Well, another way to say it is after you make the identification,
right,
you really don't have a boundary anymore.
That's right.
And so you're saying that your solution is a smooth solution on this compact manifold without
a
boundary.
Right. That's right. Yeah. But you have to bear in mind that this is, it's twisted. Okay, this, you see, if you run around this manifold here and you come in this side, this omega minus field is odd. So if you graphed it along that line, omega minus would go to zero linearly. Okay? And then you come back in here, of course it increases linearly. That doesn't look like a solution of the equations. However, if omega minus is this twisted field, then it gets a minus sign in this reversal when you come through this coordinate boundary. So only if you regard this omega minus as twisted does it really solve the classical field equations. Okay, so that's the setup which we proposed. And we then went and, by the way, you can find analytic solutions to these instantons if the potential takes a special form, if it's if V equals e to the root 2/3 kappa phi, then there's an analytic solution which actually may be understood as a dimensionally reduced five sphere. If you take five-dimensional gravity with a cosmological constant, dimensionally reduced, you get 4D gravity with a scalar field with this potential. And in 5D gravity with the lambda, there is a five-sphere solution. And so if you dimensionally reduce that five-sphere, you get a four-sphere, but with singular points of exactly this form. So There is a way of understanding this by embedding it in five dimensions, but to me it seems the four-dimensional view is more profound. Okay. Now I want to just mention, time is out, so I'm going to mention that using this Hamiltonian reduction technique, we've computed the spectrum of modes around these instantons. Okay, the one we needed to get the cosmological perturbations we did first, but the homogeneous modes we've also computed. We showed that Hawking-Moss instantons and Coleman dilution instantons have one negative mode. And to me that says that you cannot use these instantons to start the universe. They're not, they don't define the Euclidean vacuum, a sensible Euclidean vacuum. They really are something to do with tunneling. By the way, I should say that these calculations don't, the literature is terribly confusing on this, okay? And I would say that, you know, we've used the sort of rather brutal Hamiltonian methods, which are ugly. As far as I know, the covariant methods are not in any shape to do these calculations. For example, it was a nice paper which Joe Polchinski wrote about negative modes on S4. And with that method, he got two negative modes. But with this Hamiltonian method, you get zero. And I think zero is the right answer. So
-1 -1 -1.
Okay, so this Hamiltonian method doesn't seem to be as ambiguous. We computed the negative modes for all of these things, and then we did it for the singular instantons in this regularized framework. And what we found is rather bizarre, that I just need to show this picture. So this is in a paper on HEPTH, which came out on September the 1st. And what we found is that these RP4 things, remember there's this one parameter family of classical solutions, and there was one solution of lowest action. Okay? What we found is that there is a constraint here that we're applying in these solutions. The constraint that we're applying is the volume of this S3 in the conformally blown up frame. So if you like, it's the volume of a point. Anyway, there's a value for this volume of a point. It's a degree of freedom which is emerging at the singularity. So there's
you
this...
You are imposing...
They're constrained...
There.
Absolutely.
So and I still don't see how that boundary term would affect the equation of motion.
Maybe that's right. We need to discuss that. I think they're waiting to come in. So basically the high field solutions turn out not to have a negative mode, and the low field ones do have a negative mode. And what we claim is that these high field solutions, when viewed as constrained instantons, may actually provide a sensible Euclidean ground state. Okay, I better end there. Thanks.